He found the place where Billy said he had picked up the Riata. Sure enough, the tracks of a big horse with a long, beautiful stride. For an hour he followed a winding trail through the brush, skirting the town rather than riding away from it and taking a devious route. Suddenly the rider had come out into a lane, and Chantry swore softly. The trail was gone, wiped out in cow tracks. He drew up, pushed his hat back on his head, and studied the situation. This was another indication that the murderer, if it was indeed the man who was riding the sorrel, had been familiar with the town and its people. For he had come toward this spot, knowing that it was along this lane old man Peterson drove his dairy herd, the herd that supplied milk and butter to the town. Each morning and each evening that herd went along this lane, successfully wiping out any tracks that might have been left. Yet this again made Chantry puzzled. Whoever had done it had gambled the tracker would quit here, or had not known how a good tracker works, a mistake Johnny McCoy would not be likely to make. For Boyden Chantry simply rode out of the lane where the cattle had traveled and rode as closely parallel to it as possible, owing to the crowding brush. Unless the rider of the sorrel was going into Peterson's home corral, he had to turn off somewhere. And on the other side there were barns, corrals, the backs of yards belonging to people of the town. Taking his time, studying the ground as he rode, Borden Chantry worked his way in and around the brush until suddenly he saw the tracks where the sorrel had turned off. Riding through thick brush, he had even left a few hairs on the stiff branches of the brush. A little bored by the obviousness of it, Chantry fell in behind and followed the trail at a canter. It dipped into a dry wash, up the other side after 100 yards or so, then through a scattered forest of juniper, and up to shelving rock where the rider had held to the rock as much as possible. Obviously he was trying to leave no trail, but Chantry held his pace. The white hoof scars made by iron shoes upon the rock were obvious enough. Suddenly he lost the trail, swung in a wide circle, and picked it up again. The trail merged with another, made by a track that looked familiar. Then they separated. The first track was older, since the last shower, but older. And then, as if lifted upon a magic carpet, the trail of the sorrel disappeared. No tracks. Nothing. A wide circle left and another right. Still nothing. He retraced his steps to where he had lost the trail. There was a place where the horse had stood, had moved about a bit, then vanished. Stepping down from the saddle and standing beside his horse, he studied the ground. The wind was cool, stirring his hair at the forehead. He brushed the hair back and looked back toward town, only a few miles away, but out of sight. There was a faint smell of dust and crushed cedar. How did he ever get himself into this fix, anyway? What had somebody said? If he started getting too close, he might get shot himself. And the worst of it was, he had no idea who would be shooting at him. His thoughts suddenly reverted to Kim Baca, the horse thief he had gone after. At least you knew where you stood with horse thieves. Which brought up another idea. What was Kim Baca doing in this area anyway? It was out of his bailiwick entirely. That was something he should ask about, just out of curiosity, and the answer might give him some further clue as to how the outlaw mind operated. He studied the ground again. Now what could have happened here? There were no magic carpets in eastern Colorado in this day and time, nor did horses disappear into thin air. Yet this horse had vanished. How had it vanished? If it left this place, it had to walk. Nobody could fly it out. Nobody could carry it. He saw no brush marks, as if a trail had been brushed away, something always pretty obvious, but sometimes attempted. There was no sense moving on. Sometimes a man could just wear himself out moving around when he is just a sight better off to stay put and ponder. That was how he came to see that thread. It wasn't more than an inch or two long, and it was hung up under a prickly pear, but it was a thread from a toe sack, what some folks call burlap. There it was, plain as shootin'. Whoever had been riding that horse had gotten down and wrapped its hooves in burlap. Now, that horse wasn't going to go far with those contraptions on its feet. And it didn't. About a quarter of a mile further, he found a place where the arroyo bank had caved, and as he pulled up on the Appaloosa, a coyote went slinking away down the canyon. There below him was a heap of rock and dirt that had fallen from the rim some 10 feet above. It had either caved or been caved. Leaving his horse standing, Chantry dug in his heels and went down the slide. Pulling loose a large rock, he toppled it off to one side, then scraped at the dirt. As the dirt came away, a bit of sorrel hide was revealed. It took the better part of an hour to get enough dirt moved, what with more caving, and to get at the horse's side, than to uncover it to look for the brand. It was gone. The brand had been cut away in a neat circle, taking off a piece of hide about 8 or 9 inches in diameter. The brand was gone, and with it, all chance of identifying either horse or man. Borden Chantry swore softly, bitterly. Then he started to rise, and one leg cramped, and he staggered. It was all that saved him. He felt the sharp whip of the bullet as it passed. Chapter 4 Borden Chantry was a quiet, easygoing, but serious-minded man who had known little but hard work most of his life, and expected nothing to be that easy. Although an expert with both pistol and rifle, he had never felt the necessity of proving it to any man, and the few fights he had were with fists. A man with a quiet sense of humor and laugh wrinkles at the corners of his eyes, he was not amused now. That bullet had come too close, and whoever fired was shooting for the money. His reaction was instinctive and correct. He threw himself down and rolled over into the shelter of the opposite bank of the arroyo. His horse was on the bank some 30 yards away and across the arroyo, and he was of no mind to try getting to his horse with a rifleman waiting for him to do just that. Working his way swiftly along the bank, he came to a place where the bank curved sharply west, which was in the direction from which the would-be killer had fired. He rounded the curve, rifle up and ready for a shot from the hip, and when the wash was empty before him, he scrambled up a notch where additional water had trickled down, and lying there, he listened. Nothing. He had ridden over this area several times in rounding up strays, and knew that some dozen yards from where he now lay there was a nest of brush and boulders. It would be a perfect spot from which to survey the area, but it might be the spot where the killer waited. He considered that. Normally a cautious man, anger made him aggressive, and he did not like lying still, waiting for another shot. His were the instincts of the hunter, and for the moment, hunting was what he was paid for. So he came out of the notch at a run and sprinted for the nest of boulders. A rifle barked somewhere off to his left, but the shot came late and too far back, and the next instant he was into the rocks and getting lined up for a shot. Then he heard the drum of horses' hooves, and slowly he relaxed. Undoubtedly the unknown marksman was getting away, so let him go. Yet Borden Chantry waited. He hunched down in a good spot where he could see all around him and where he had his horse in his field of vision. He waited a slow half hour, then got up and walked slowly off in the direction from which the shots had come. The air was cool, coming on to rain. A half hour's scouting brought him nothing, yet the man's horse had to have been tied somewhere. And reluctantly Borden gave up the search and crossed the arroyo to get his own horse. Mounting, he rode back and searched again. No luck. With more time, maybe. He turned his horse toward home, stripped the gear, and turned it into the corral. Kim Baca was a slender, wiry young man, half Irish, the other half Spanish and Apache. No more than 22... He was already a known man in 4 states, 2 territories, and Mexico. He had a lean, saturnine face, a quizzical sense of humor, and was known to be a dead shot, yet he had never been involved in any shooting scrapes. Warden Chantry picked up his keys and walked back to the cell. Over his shoulder, he called, "Big Engine, bring us a pot of coffee and a couple of cups." He opened the cell and stepped in, leaving the door ajar for Big Engine. Kimbaka looked up at him, smiling faintly. "Aren't you scared I'll get away?" Chantry grinned and shrugged. "Go ahead, if you feel lucky." Baka laughed. "Not me. The odds are all wrong. Besides, I saw you in a couple of fights. You're no bargain."
"Thanks."
Chantry tilted his chair back against the wall. "Kim, what in God's name made you pull a fool thing like lifting Johnson's horses? Everybody in the country knows that team."
"How was I to know that? Anyway, I was mad. Somebody beat me to the horse I was after."
"Was it a hunch? Or had he guessed it before this?"
Chantry looked up at him. "Big Sorrel? Three White Stockings?"
Baka stared at him, then took the toothpick on which he was chewing and threw it to the floor.
"You mean you had me pegged? You even knew what horse I was after?"
"Mighty fine horse," Chantry replied, admitting nothing. "I wouldn't blame you."
Baka got up.
"Marshal, you just don't know. That was one of the fastest stepping horses I ever saw. Gentle as a baby, yet it could go all day and all night. I tell you, I could have loved that horse. I mean it. I never wanted anything so bad in my life."
"Know who owned it?"
"Hell no. I picked him up in Raton Pass. I saw that horse coming and figured it might be the law on my tail, so I put my glass on him. You never saw a horse move like that one. I just told myself, Kim, this is it. That's your horse. So I fell in behind him. I had to watch my step, too, because that rider, whoever he was canny. I hadn't been following him more than a few miles before he knew it. Somehow or other, he gave me the slip, and I lost him until I rode into Trinidad and saw the horse tied to a hitching rail there."
"Remember the brand?"
Chantry spoke casually, yet he was mentally holding his breath. Did Baka hesitate?
"No,"
he said. "I can't say that I do."
"You see any more of him?"
"No."
Was there another instant of hesitation?
"I heard him ask after this town, so I came on ahead. Rode in here and waited for him to make it. Then he never showed."
"You never saw him again?"
"Marshal,"
Kimbaka spoke slowly,
"I got a thing about horses. I wouldn't admit to a thing in court, and if you say I said this, I'll say I never. But I never stole a horse to sell. I stole him because I wanted him. I wanted him my own self. Except that team of Johnson's. I never figured to steal them horses, just got mad and stole them out of spite when I didn't get the sorrel."
Borden Chantry filled Kim's cup and his own. He had an idea of what was in Kim's mind. He was a known horse thief, caught with the goods. In many places that would have meant an immediate hanging, yet Chantry had arrested him, brought him back, and was holding him in jail. A man had been murdered. That man's horse had disappeared. What more likely suspect than Kimbaka? What easier way to close the books on a crime?
"Baka," he said slowly, "you punched a lot of cows in your time. You had the name of being a top hand. Now you're in trouble. We can send you to the pen, and you wouldn't cotton to that any more than me. Back yonder when I nabbed you, I could have shot you and nobody would have cared or even asked how come. I didn't. I took you in without a fight."
"You was slick. I gotta admit it. And I was too damn sure of myself."
"Well, whatever. Thing is, you know I'll play square if there's a way I can do it, and I'm not against giving you a break if you come clean. You know a good deal more than you said. You tell me, and I'll try to talk Johnson out of pressing charges."
Kim stared into his coffee cup, and Chantry felt sympathy for the man. Right now, Baka was trying to study out how much he could trust Chantry.
"All right. You've been square."
Trouble is, I don't know much, only that somebody stole that sorrel before I could. Right from under my nose.
Did you see it done?
No, I never.
Do you know who did it? That hesitation again.
No. No, I don't.
Kim put down his cup.
Look, Marshall. I stood around the street watching for that horse and rider. They never showed. And then I saw the rider. So where's the horse? I studied on that, and knowing which way the man would come into town, I started studying on places that horse might be. I pegged it for one of two places, either that stable with the corral and the two-room shack over east, or Mary Ann Haley's.
The shack over east would be Johnny McCoy's. But why Mary Ann's? He asked the question, and Baca shrugged.
He went there. That rider did. He went mighty early in the morning when they aren't receiving guests as a rule, only they let him ride in. I figured they know him, the way they opened up for him, so I checked their stable. No horses, but they're driving horses for their rig. So then I went to the other place. That horse was sure enough there, but I heard stirring around inside and I took myself away from there.
And then?
I come back that night, real late. And I seen a man riding off on that sorrel, slipping off mighty quiet-like. I know a thief when I see one, and that man was a thief.
Would you know him if you saw him?
No. No, I don't think so. He was kind of humped over in the saddle so you couldn't make out his height.
Borden Chantry opened the cell door and stepped out, closing it after him. Take your time with the coffee, Baca, and give it a thought. You're a good man on the trail. You help me, and I'll help you. He went into the street and stood there, pulling his hat brim down against the glare. A wagon was coming slowly up the street, and Johnson's dog got up lazily and moved out of the way. Well, what did that get him? That Mary Ann Haley had seen the dead man, had welcomed him, or somebody had, like a friend. He shook his head. That didn't gel with what he already knew or surmised about the victim. What business could he have with a woman like Mary Ann? That early in the morning, when they weren't in the habit of receiving guests. He tried to add it all up, and came to nothing. You're not much of a detective, Borden, he told himself. A stranger had ridden into town with a poke of money, gold probably. The following morning he was dead, murdered. His horse had been taken out and killed. The brand cut away. Two things he knew, or was sure of in his own mind. The murderer was a local man, and he had not wanted the victim identified, which made the brand all important. He turned to start down the street and came face to face with Frank Hurley. Hurley made as if to turn away, but Chantry saw him in time. Frank! Grudgingly, the man stopped. He was a lean, hard-visaged man who now carried a badly swollen eye, a split lip, and a swollen ear. You look like you tangled with a buzzsaw, Chantry said, or somebody with a bunch of knuckles. You want to see me about something? If you do, say so, or I'm going down the street. Chantry smiled. Frank, if you take a step before I tell you to, I'll throw you in jail for loitering. Now, you tell me. Who gave you the eye? None of your damn business. Where's Pugsy? Up at the shack, I reckon. He minds his affairs, I mind mine. Tell me about it, Frank. If the story sounds good, I may not arrest you for murder. Frank Hurley's skin tightened. He glanced quickly, right and left. Now see here, Marshal. That kind of talk can get a man hung. I never murdered nobody. Nobody, do you hear? The dead man had skinned knuckles. You have been hit, obviously. I could build a case out of that, Frank.
I never done nothing. You lay off. Lay off, do you hear? Tom Reardon says,
You can tell time for me that unless you boys tell me what you know, I may throw all three of you in jail. You've all had it coming for a long time. The murdered man was in Time's place. There's evidence you were in a brawl, and so was he. And I haven't heard of a fight all week. You think about it, Frank.
Then if you're in a mind to talk, come around. He went home for dinner. At the table, he told his wife about the case, reviewing it as much for himself as for her.
I got to talk to Marianne, he said at last. Bess stiffened.
Is that necessary, Borden? Is it really? What could that woman know? Of course the man went there, but isn't it rather obvious?
Not at that hour.
He sat long over dinner, staring out at the sunlit street. It was a whole lot simpler out there on the range herding cows, branding stock, or doping the stock for screwworms. He could chase down a horse thief, or throw a drunk in jail, or take a gun off somebody. But figuring out a murder? He shook his head. The one thing he had not mentioned to Bess was the shot taken at him. No use to worry her. She disliked the job in its every aspect, but what would they do otherwise? Money was scarce.
What had become of the stranger's money?
Talking to Frank Hurley had been just a straw thrown into the wind. He knew pretty much what had happened that night, and although he could prove none of it, he could have written a report on it with what he knew was true.
I'd lay a bet, he told Bess, that Frank and Pugsy followed the stranger into a dark street somewhere and jumped him. Only that stranger knew how to take care of himself and whipped them both, whipped them good. Only I'd like to know where the stranger was going and where he was coming from. I think time will have them tell me. He's no fool. Any man who would kill a horse like that wasn't worth shooting.
So why had he killed it? Why not just take it out and turn it loose to go home?
To go home and perhaps start somebody backtrailing to see what happened to the rider. That had to be the reason. The killer did not want that tough outfit Reardon had referred to riding into town. So he had killed the horse, cut away the brand so it and its owner could not be identified, then caved dirt over it in hopes it might never be found. If the dead man had been treated like others who had fallen in drunken fights, as the killer planned, no clue would have been left. Picking up his hat, he went to the door.
I'll be back for supper, Bess. If you need me, I'll be up on the street.
Or at that Haley woman's place.
Part of the job, Bess. When a man sets out to enforce the law, he doesn't expect to move in the best company. Anyway, from all I hear, she's not a bad woman. Maybe not a good woman, but not a bad one.
He went out quickly before Bess could reply to that, and walked slowly up the street. He stopped on the corner, thinking. People went by and nodded or spoke, and he knew how he looked to them. He wore the badge. He was authority. He was the personification of the law. He looked strong, invulnerable, capable. Yet if they only knew. He grinned ruefully at nothing at all. What did he have? Pugsy and Frank were definitely suspects. They'd undoubtedly had a fight with the victim and might have murdered him later. Johnny McCoy was a drunk, not always responsible for his actions, and Johnny had stabled the man's horse, knew he had gold on his person. Time Reardon, a lawless, ruthless man, who also knew the stranger carried gold, a man who often went for rides in the late afternoon or evening.
Rides to where? And for what?
He thought of old Mrs. Riggin. George had a murder in his day, too.
And maybe she would know how he handled it.
Any help he could get, he could use. So he would go see her, and he would see Marianne. Oddly enough, he felt uncomfortable about that. Essentially a shy, lonely person, he had known few women. There had been a girl in Leavenworth when he was a boy, and another in Sedalia when he'd gone back there with some cattle. And then he had met Bess. And after that, no other girl really entered his thoughts. He had talked to Marianne more than once on the street, and at least once in her kitchen. But he avoided the girls, and as he wore the badge, they avoided him.
He frowned in sudden memory. People had mentioned the murder victim crossing and recrossing the street. Going where?
The restaurant? Reardon's? George Blazer had seen him on the street.
What about the bank?
What about Hyatt Johnson?
Chapter 5.
Leaning on an awning post in front of the general store, Borden Chantry chewed on a match and tried to put it all together. Unwillingly, he kept thinking of Hyatt Johnson, feeling guilty all the while because he had never really liked Hyatt. In that part of the country, in that period, there was no great affection for bankers or railroad men. The former had foreclosed on too many properties when poor men were unable, due to weather and grazing conditions, to pay their bills. The latter because the rates the railroad charged were felt to be too high. Borden Chantry, with a large ranch and a good reputation, had no success in getting a reasonable loan and reasonable rates that might have kept him in business. Hyatt had offered to buy his land at a price far below its value, or had offered a mortgage at rates he had no chance of ever paying, so Borden had refused both offers. He had his land, but he had no cattle. He would have thought Johnson merely short-sighted if he had not known that the banker wanted his land. Yet the banker had to be considered. The murdered man had gone to the bank. He had been carrying money. Sometime during those few hours that money had disappeared. Had it been deposited? If so, would Hyatt tell him? It was a common saying around town that money went into Hyatt's bank, but none came out. That wasn't, of course, literally true, yet it betrayed the town's feeling about Hyatt Johnson, for which there had been some reason. Since he had been turned down for his loan almost a year before, Borden Chantry had not entered the bank, and his exchange of greetings on the street had always been coolly formal. Crossing the street, he strolled up toward the bank. Ed Pearson was in town, Chantry observed, buying supplies for his mining claims. Ed lived off to the north, and Chantry had intended to stop all night there when bringing Kim Baca back to jail, only Pearson had not been home. Of a sudden, Chantry stopped and looked back, mentally estimating the load Pearson was putting on his wagon. He whistled softly. Ed must be doing well, for he was buying heavy, very heavy. The interior of the bank was cool and shadowed. Lem Parkin was behind the wicket, wearing a green eyeshade and sleeve garters.
"Howdy, Marshall. Don't often see you in here."
"Not much occasion for it, Lem. My salary doesn't leave much. Is Mr. Johnson in?"
"In the office. Doors open. Just walk on back."
Hyatt Johnson was a cool, hard-eyed man with a level gaze and less expression than a hard-boiled egg. He looked up at the tall, broad-shouldered young man with no pleasure. He did want Chantry's land, and intended to have it. The 10 sections Chantry owned were worth little at land prices of the day, and Hyatt Johnson knew that at the moment less valuable land was going for $1 an acre, and sometimes less, with times the way they were. Borden Chantry's land was a different story, for he had a good creek running through it as well as several year-round water holes, and Hyatt knew a dozen men who would pay $10 to $12 an acre for the place and jump at the chance. He also knew there were banks in several western towns not too far off who would give Chantry a loan with no argument, and at the best rates. Fortunately, Chantry did not know this, and Hyatt had no intention of telling him. He wanted the Chantry land. Once he had it, and he was sure he would get it eventually, he would sell off a small piece to recover whatever it cost him, and hold the rest. Borden Chantry lived off his salary, and no Western Marshal could be expected to live long, so Hyatt was waiting. Not too long, he hoped. His lips were a little dry when he looked up. Chantry wasted no time.
"Hyatt," he said shortly, "I am investigating a murder."
"Murder?"
Hyatt was startled.
"You mean a killing?"
"I mean a murder. Tall, nice-looking man, 30 or so, might be less, wore a beaded buckskin jacket, Plains Indian style, but I figure he came from the Southwest."
Hyatt Johnson sat back in his swivel chair.
"You mean you are of the opinion this was not simply a drunken brawl, a casual shooting?"
"I do. It was murder. Then the killer tried to cover it up. He changed the dead man's shirt, put on his coat. Before he put the coat on, he shot him in the chest so he would have a wound to prove he'd been shot from in front. Then he took him out and dropped him in the street."
"What has all that to do with me?"
"The first step in figuring out who killed him is to identify him, find out where he stayed,
and why he came to town in the first place. Also, he was known to be carrying a poke filled with gold coins. Hyatt Johnson shrugged.
I still can't see where I come in.
He was in your bank before he was killed. All I want to know is what he wanted here, and if he gave you a name. Hyatt Johnson was disturbed. In all his dealings with ranchers, he had found most of them were relatively poor businessmen, knowing little aside from cattle and grazing, and often with only a rudimentary knowledge of those subjects. To turn a herd of cattle loose on free range and then to make a gather and sell off the fat, mature stock required very little intelligence, as he saw it. Now Borden Chantry was showing a brand of reasoning he had not suspected. Pure chance, no doubt. Yet why would he take off a man's coat and shirt when he had obviously been shot?
Yes, he replied. I believe... Yes, the man was in here, but he didn't give me a name. His business, however, was confidential. I'm afraid I cannot divulge any part of it.
I'm speaking for the law, Hyatt, not for myself.
Nevertheless...
Chantry stood up. Looks like I'll have to get a court order, he said, if that's the way you want it. Hyatt Johnson was irritated. Now where did this cowboy ever hear of a court order?
Very well, he replied tersely. Now, if that is all...
For the time, Hyatt, for the time. Borden walked back to the street, feeling his defeat. To tell the truth, he knew nothing about court orders. He had read or heard somewhere of somebody getting one to get at some papers. Well, he could try. He would see Judge Alex McKinney. For a few minutes, he simply stood in the street. It was an easy street, lazy-seeming and dusty, too warm part of the time, too cold and windy at others, yet it had the advantage of being familiar. He knew all the people on that street, knew what they were about. He recognized the rigs that stood there, knew the brands on the saddled stock along the hitching rail, and knew who rode most of the horses. Most of them were men he had worked with, men he knew and trusted. Yet somewhere among them was a murderer, which proved there was at least one man he did not know. Who? Who killed the stranger, and why? Why would a man want to kill? For gold, the most obvious reason. Or for revenge? For fear? Or over a woman? In a sudden fit of anger, maybe. In a dispute over a card game or horse race or something. Yet a man in such a shooting had every chance of not even being arrested. And if you wished to kill a man, you could find some reason for drawing on him. Unless, of course, you knew the other man was better with a gun than you were. Or, even if he might be almost as good... Such a man might die, but kill you in the process. Sorting over what he knew, he realized that nobody had told him the whole truth. Kim Baca knew more than he admitted, and so did both Johnny McCoy and his son. It was very likely that Hyatt Johnson knew enough to clear up the case. Hyatt, a cool, hard, careful man, a good shot at deer or antelope, or turkeys, for that matter, and a man who always played with the odds in his favor. Johnny, who drank too much, was notoriously short of money, and Kim Baca, who had the skill, the intelligence, to outwit any of them. Including me, he said aloud. He had to see the judge about a court order, and he must talk to Marianne. He walked across to the Bon Ton, feeling guilty because he was procrastinating. He was avoiding going out to Marianne's. Some of the town gossips would see him going in there, and their tongues would wag. Chrissy was over from the post office. She usually brewed her own tea in the back of the office, so if she was here, it was because she was either picking up gossip or spreading some. Still, Chrissy was a good woman, a good postmistress, and a public-spirited citizen. She was also a good person to have on your side if it came to politics or business about the town or country. She not only would say what she believed, but she believed a lot of things, and said it about all of them. He sat down near the window where he could watch the street. He knew she would be inquiring, but he was also curious about what she had come over for. It took no more than a minute to find out.
Marianne's a sick woman.
That's what Dr. Williger says. He says she's got consumption. She needs rest.
Elsie Carter was over from the hotel, and she half-turned in her chair.
Wonder some of those folks out west wouldn't show up. Just don't know, probably. But Mary Ann Haley helped them when they needed it. At least that's what they say.
What's that?
Prissy demanded.
Why, it was out Nevada way. Or maybe it was in Montana. Smallpox hit that mining camp and everybody come down with it. Most of the women folks in town got scared and they ran. They got out, and those men that could travel, they went too. There was maybe 20-25 men left in town, and most of them down with smallpox, and Mary Ann, she just pitched in and nursed them all. She got them together in the town hall, and she stayed right with them, morning, noon, and night. At least, that's what they say.
Nobody said anything for a while, and then it was Prissy who suggested,
"We could take up a collection."
Elsie shook her head.
"Nobody's got much, Prissy. And there's a good many would say it was the Lord's will, what's happening to her. I doubt we could get enough for a ticket on the stage, let alone anything for her keep when she got there, wherever she goes."
He said nothing, staring out the window. They were right, of course. Something should be done. But he also knew there was no way a collection could be gathered for Mary Ann. Unless, he chuckled at the thought, they would do it just to get her out of town. His thoughts returned to Johnny McCoy. With luck, the Irishman might be sober now, and if he was, he might have a deal to say. He filled his cup and stared up the street, and Prissy had spoken twice to him before he realized.
"Marshall, you found who killed that man?"
"It takes a while, ma'am. I'm working on it." She sniffed.
"Doesn't appear to me like you're doing much but settin'."
"Now, Prissy, a man's a fool to go off half-cocked. A thing like this, a man's got to think on it. He's got to figure."
Prissy looked at him and shook her head. "I don't know, Marshall. Maybe you're not the man for the job. Why, that nice Lang Adams. We could have had him for Marshall, and he's a bright man whose thoughts aren't all taken up with cows and horses."
"Lang would have been a good Marshall," he admitted. "And I hear he's a good hand with a pistol. I know he can shoot turkeys."
"That's all you men think about, shooting.
Shooting's got nothing to do with it. You've got to think, Marshall. Think."
"Yes, I know that."
"Now, old George Riggin, he was Marshal here for a long time, and a good man, too. He always said that Dover shooting was a murder, but nobody really believed him. Of course, nobody knew what George was really thinking. He just went about his business, and if he talked to anybody, it was to Helen. If he hadn't died, well, I always did say that if he hadn't died, he would have found out who killed Pin Dover. Why, I talked to him just a day or two before he was killed, and he told me then that he thought he had the answer. George wasn't one to talk, not him. He was a stern man. And very quiet, but I'd known George more than 10 years, and when he was in the post office asking about some mail, he told me that he'd have the killer."
"Nonsense," Elsie said sharply. "There was no killer. George was just a funnin'. He did that now and again. And those folks who thought somebody did him in, why, he just got killed by a rock slide. Happens all the time."
"Does it?" Prissy said tartly. "One day he says he'll have the killer, next day he's dead. I'd say that slide happened mighty nigh right for the killer, whoever he was." Borden remembered the funeral. He had known old George, as he had known everybody in town, to speak to. They had talked a time or two, and a couple of times he'd ridden on posses with the old man. He was no fool, George Riggin wasn't.
"Nonsense. Some folks see murder under every rock. I'd take that young man who got killed. I don't believe for a minute he was murdered any more than any of those drunks who get all whiskied up and shoot or knife each other."
Most of them thought he was a fool, making a mystery out of something so simple. Borden Chantry looked down at his empty cup and could not remember taking those last swallows. He pushed back his chair and got up. It was time to go see Mary Ann. "Pris," he suggested, "if you see the judge, tell him I want to see him. I'll be back in a short time."
Ain't been down for his mail, so I reckon you'll see him right here. He coffees up whenever he gets mail and reads it whilst he drinks. But I'll tell him. Just you be back to see him when he gets here.
They all heard the shot. It was some distance off, but it had a clear, distinct report that cut across their conversation, stilling their tongues, leaving them staring. Shots were not uncommon at night, occasionally in the daytime, but rarely in the late afternoon before the drinkers got well started and after the hunters had come in, if any.
Yet there was something about that shot that hit them all. And for a moment they just stared, frightened and wondering.
Borden Chantry got up and went outside. He knew it as well as if he'd seen it happen. Somebody else was dead. Chapter 6. He lay sprawled at the door of the stable, his face in the fresh straw, one hand outflung and holding a bridle, the other by his side, empty. The hands were seamed and gnarled with work, such work as even the months of hard drinking had failed to eradicate. From earliest childhood, Johnny McCoy had only known work and had never shirked his share, only to have the drink catch up to him at last. Billy stood beside the body when they came running, his face white, his eyes wide and staring. "Bill," Chantry put a hand on the thin shoulder. "I'm sorry, boy." Even as he spoke, he was noting the bullet hole in the side of the skull, his eyes sweeping the area for the place of the marksman. It was no use running and chasing, for the man would be long gone, and to rush in now with a lot of would-be pursuers would only trample any evidence that might have been left. There were a dozen men there, and as many women. Borden turned slowly to face them. "Now listen," he said loudly, "and hear me plain. You're each to go directly to your homes and stop for nothing on the way. Go directly there and stay in until morning, or settle with me." "What about my business?" Reardon demanded. "One night won't hurt you," Chantry said coolly, "and I don't want everything tramped up and spoiled. With luck, I'll have found what I want by daylight."
"And what'll that be?"
Blazer demanded irritably.
"That's my business," Chantry replied brusquely. "Just get on home now."
"And what if we don't?"
Pugsy Kern demanded. Borden Chantry smiled.
"Why, I'll throw you in jail for disturbing the peace, for loitering, and as many other charges as I can find to answer the bill. But any loyal citizen who wants this mystery cleared up will do all he can to help."
"That goes with me," Lang Adams said. "Anything you need, Bord, you just call out."
Big Engine was there with the wagon, and they loaded Johnny McCoy into the back. Borden dropped his hand to Billy's shoulder.
"Son, you'd better go along to my house. Bess and Tom will be mighty glad to have you with us."
Reluctantly, the boy went, stunned and silent. As yet, there had been no tears. That would come, Borden knew, when Billy was alone and away from watching eyes. Slowly the crowd scattered to their homes, and there they would stay, unless the killer was among them. For what better thing for him to do than run up and join the crowd? One by one he sorted them out in his mind, then shook his head. No, not in that bunch. Hardly likely. Yet he remained uneasy. He simply did not know, and all his clues seemed to lead to nothing. Johnny had himself been a suspect, although not a serious one in Chantry's thinking. Yet he had to be considered. He had stabled the dead man's horse. He had known the man had money. Now Johnny was dead, and the question was, why was he killed? What had Johnny known that the killer dared not let him tell? And Johnny was sobering up. Johnny, who had always been a hard-working, loyal man. The question now was, did Billy know what Johnny had known, or what the killer thought he knew? If the murderer believed the boy might know something dangerous to him, the boy himself might be the next victim. Standing in the very spot where Johnny McCoy had stood, Chantry turned slowly around, studying the angle at which the bullet must have come. Years of using guns, trying to make every shot count, and using a gun always with purpose and never for casual amusement, had taught him a good deal about guns.
It had also taught him a great deal about the men who use guns. This man was shooting to kill, not to frighten or wound. Therefore, he must have been confident of his marksmanship, as well as of his position. It was still light, so the man must have been concealed, must have fired, then abandoned his position instantly. He must have abandoned it in such a way that he would not be noticed, or if noticed, his presence would surprise no one. Rarely is anyone unobserved. Even when they are most sure they are unseen, there is nearly always an eye to see, and often a mind to wonder. Hence the unknown marksman had to select a concealed position to which he could gain access without being seen, or if seen, it had to be a position where his presence would not require explanation. Johnny, of course, might have turned as the bullet struck, might even have been starting to bend down. The bullet holes had seemed to be slightly slanted down, as though fired from a slightly higher elevation. Borden Chantry stood with his hands on his hips, looking around. If the killer had remained in firing position, he would now have him, Chantry, under the gun. And he had already been shot at once. Slowly, he turned. There were two second-story windows in the bank building from which a bullet could have come. There was one over the stage station office, allowing for some movement from Johnny after he was shot, and there were two or three barns. These barns each had a loft with doors or windows from which shots might have been fired. All were within 200 yards, no great distance, certainly. He prowled about, going from barn to barn, studying distances and elevations. At last he halted and stared around with disgust. What was he trying to do? He was no investigator. Of course, it was like tracking, and he had done a lot of that. Walking back to the McCoy cabin, he sat down on the stoop. It had become dark. Only a few stars were out, and it was clouding up. Just suppose the killer had done as he had first thought. Suppose the killer had fired his shot, then run down to the body. If he had done that, then what had become of his rifle? Borden Chantry got up quickly. His asking people to go home had been in hopes no tracks would be made to cover up those he was looking for, but suppose that had trapped the killer. For if the killer had run down to the body, then he had left his rifle either at or near the spot from which the shot had been fired. Moreover, he must return and get that rifle before he, Borden Chantry, could find it. If that was true, then before many hours were passed, the killer must leave his living quarters, wherever they might be, and slip through the streets and alleys, get the rifle, and get back to his room. Borden Chantry walked into the street and stood there for a moment, making a mental picture of the town. Yet the more he sized up the situation, the less he liked it. There had been no real clue in the position of the body of the original victim, but with McCoy it was different, and it offered possibilities. Too many possibilities. From where McCoy had fallen, he could have been shot from any one of six directions, and Chantry could eliminate none of them offhand. The trouble was that a man shot dead does not always drop in his tracks. He might have made a full turn, a half turn, or just turned his head, so the angle of the wound was of slight help, no more. Sighting from the spot where the body had fallen, there was a direct line of sight to the bank, the rear door of the bank, or either of two upstairs windows. There was also a direct line from the back door or window of the Corral Saloon. Lines could also be laid out to Marianne Haley's, the back of the stage company office, the stage company corrals and stable, as well as the back of the restaurant. There were just too many possibilities. When it came to that, there was a direct line of sight from his own kitchen to the spot where McCoy fell. Irritably, he shook away the thought. Bess? It was impossible. Yet out of fairness, he must suspect everybody. If only he could come upon some clue to the man's identity. Borden Chantry walked slowly up the dusty street, and turning aside, walked toward the rear corner of the Corral Saloon. The shot could have been fired from here. Carefully, he checked the area. No fresh tracks that he could make out, no cartridge shell, no indication that anyone had stood there. He crossed the street to the cafe and went between it and the post office, then walked along behind the buildings to the rear of the stage office. He had no reason to think Blazer might have shot McCoy, but he could not rule it out either, so he scouted the area thoroughly, then around the corral and the barn where spare horses were kept for the stages. Nothing. The night was cool. It was clouding over, and it would be a dark night. Glancing toward the lights of his own windows, he thought he saw his wife's shadow against the curtain. She would be feeding the youngsters about now, his own son Tom and Billy McCoy. Two men murdered. And they might be separate and distinctive crimes, but he did not believe it. He walked back between the store and the jail and out on the boardwalk. The street was empty as the street of a ghost town. The people were cooperating, and that was a help. No cowboys in town during the week to speak of. He crossed the street to the rear corner of the bank and drew another blank. There was no chance of getting upstairs until tomorrow. He glanced past the corner toward Hyatt Johnson's house, a fine, big, well-built house such as befitted a banker, and a house from which the bullet might have been fired. He was turning away when he saw, beyond a couple of residences, the vast dark bulk of the old Simmons freight barn. The Simmons outfit had operated bull trains out of that barn, freighting to the western mining camps and east and north to the railroad. A year before they had closed up shop and gone out of business, selling out when the railroad built on west. Now the place was empty. What was it? It was by far the largest building in town, yet he had not even thought of it, for it stood empty and was somehow no longer even a topic of conversation. Yet from that building, from either the front of the building or from the loft, it would have been an easy shot, not over 70 yards at best from where McCoy fell. He started to cross to the old barn, then turned abruptly away and went across the street to the cafe. A light still showed there, and he could see Ed washing up. He opened the door and stepped in.
"Marshall? Just closing up. You sure killed business tonight."
"Sorry."
"Don't be. I could stand the rest. I got me a good book and some drummer passing through left me a bunch of newspapers from Omaha and St. Louis. I sure do like reading them papers. It fair worries a body to see what the world is coming to.
Why, the crime in them cities.
He couldn't give them to me. I'd rather live here, where it's safe."
"Wasn't very safe for Johnny McCoy." Ed's face was serious.
"It surely wasn't. Marshall, I liked that man. Like I said, he was a warm, generous fella. Give you the shirt off his back. If you catch the man who did it, I'd like a hand on the rope."
"I'll get him." Chantry spoke with confidence and surprised himself, for it was a confidence he did not feel. Or did he? Where had that quick reply come from? He was never a man given to making flat statements of what or what not he would do, yet the words had come as if springing from a deep well of belief within himself. "I've got to get him, Ed. This is a good town. Law-abiding town, and I took an oath to keep it so. We've had shootings and cuttings, but mostly not among the town folk. And there's a change of feeling, Ed. The old days are gone."
"Marshall, I'm gonna leave the door open. There's some meat on that tray, along with some bread and butter. There's coffee in the pot, fresh made. I had me an idea you'd be around most of the night, so I made it for you. Yonder, in the case, there's a half of apple pie. Be stale tomorrow. You help yourself. I'm going to turn in now."
"All right. Mind if I keep one light burning?"
"Figured on it. Now, Marshall, see you tomorrow."
Borden Chantry carried the pot from the stove to a table along with some slices of meat, bread, and a quarter of the pie. The light was in the kitchen, and where he sat it was in the shadow. It was dim and quiet, the room smelling faintly of coffee. Straddling a chair, he reached around the back and put a thick sandwich together. Then, with his right hand, he reached back and took the thong off his gun. Facing the street from the darkened room, he ate his sandwich and sipped coffee, ears tuned for any slightest sound, eyes for any movement. The old building creaked slightly as the heat left it. A lone dog trotted across the street, pausing to sniff some object lying in the gutter. Gradually, his eyes became more and more accustomed to the dark, and from where he sat,
Invisible himself, he could look northeast past the corner of the bank toward Hyatt's house, across the street at the Corral Saloon, lighted but empty, and southwest, past the rear of the Mexican restaurant toward Mary Ann's. The kitchen was on his left, the wall of the building behind him, and beyond that the dark area that divided the restaurant building from where his own home stood. He ate his sandwich, drank his coffee, and then poured a new cup and tied into the apple pie. He was lifting the second bite to his mouth when his eye caught a faint shifting of shadows near the rear of the bank. For a moment he was very still. Had he deceived himself? Had something really moved? Or... He put down his fork and wiped his hands on the rough napkin. He got up, stepping back from the chair, and on cat feet he went to the door. Nothing moved. Yet he had seen something. Was it the old dog? His mind told him no. The door opened easily under his hand, with only the faintest of squeaks. He stepped out on the boardwalk, crossed it with one more step, and started across the street, vaguely lit by the light from the Corral Saloon. He swore softly. If anybody was watching, they could not help but see him. The saloon seemed empty. There was no sign of anybody around. He went quickly to the corner and looked past it toward Mary Ann's. A shadow moved against the curtain, but there was no sound of music. Then he remembered. Mary Ann was ill. The Mexican cafe was dark. Holding close to the wall of the saloon, he walked toward the rear, and looking past the corner he could see the great bulk of the Simmons barn. All was black and silent. He rested a hand on his gun, straining his eyes toward the old barn. Yet he saw nothing. It was something he heard. Something he felt. Hesitating only a second, heart pounding, he crossed toward the barn. His toe kicked a small pebble and it rattled against others. He swore mentally, reached the corner of the barn, and edged along toward the door. It stood open, only a few inches. He drew a long breath, felt his mouth go dry and his heart pounding in slow, measured beats, and then he stepped through into the darkness. He felt the blow coming before it hit him. He started to turn, and then something smashed down on his skull and he felt himself falling, falling, falling. Chapter 7. He grabbed out wildly, seizing upon a boot, but the foot kicked free and he heard running steps. He yelled out, started to rise, then fell back into the straw. He must have passed out then, because the next he knew, several people were standing over him and Prissy was holding his head. Tim Reardon was there, Lang Adams and Alvarez from the Mexican cafe.
"I hear you yell, senor," Alvarez said. "I grab a gun. I am to help, but there is nobody, only you on the ground."
He got up shakily, his skull buzzing. "Thanks, I'll be all right." Prissy stood back, and as he raised his eyes, Borden could see somebody, Hyatt, undoubtedly, standing in the door of his house, light streaming past him, looking to see what the confusion was about.
"I got slugged," he explained. "Somebody was in the barn."
"Did you see him?" Reardon demanded. "Did you get a look at him?"
"No. No, I didn't. I was lucky not to get killed."
"You've got a thick skull," Lang said grimly, "or you would be dead. Bord, if you're going to keep on with this, you should have a deputy. You could get yourself killed."
I'll make out." He shook his head, but it buzzed. "I'm all right. I'll just go along home."
"You'd better wake up Dr. Williger," Lang advised. "You've got a nasty cut on your skull."
"Bess will take care of it. She's had experience."
Somebody handed him his hat and he checked his gun, still in its holster.
"You'll go along home now. I'll be all right."
Lang hesitated.
"Bored? If I can help?"
"Thanks, Lang. I'll be all right."
When they had gone, he turned to the Mexican, who was the last to leave.
"Alvarez?"
He turned.
"Si."
"Were you the first one here?"
"Si. I think so, senor."
"Did you see anything? Anybody?"
"I think, maybe. Somebody was in the barn, I think. I hear somebody, and there was a light, then a curse, curses, then somebody ran.
Señor?
Alvarez looked up at him.
I think there were two people in there. I hear curses, then like a scramble, and I'm coming running.